To learn, you have to have teachers. And who's your teacher? And the teacher is nature, the earth. You learn, and you learn how to get along. You learn how to be respectful.
Welcome to the Sacred Land Film Project's audio archive, where we revisit the footage we left on the cutting room floor over 40 years of filmmaking. I'm your host, Toby McLeod. Today we hear from Onondaga Elder Orrin Lyons, one of the big thinkers who we interviewed for our four-part series, Standing on Sacred Ground. I first met Orrin Lyons back in 1980 when I was an intern at Mother Jones Magazine. I was handling the logistics for a conference on the dangers of technology. I remember walking through the Mills College Library in Oakland with Anishinaabe activist Winona LaDuke, who was then just 20 years old, and seeing the writer Barry Lopez and Native American leader Orrin Lyons sitting in two leather chairs as they talked late into the night. We served them tea. Orrin Lyons was much like the Hopi elders I was just getting to know, quiet, imposing, thoughtful, and intimidating. I kept my distance, and many years would pass before I really got to know him. 20 years later, when we were working on our Standing on Sacred Ground series, I knew that Orrin could help us frame the significance of sacred places and infuse the films with indigenous knowledge. He agreed to be interviewed, and we sat down in Monument Valley in 2011, after we had both attended a memorial gathering for Hopi elder Thomas Binyakya in northern Arizona. We set up near a highway, and apparently under a jet path. Throughout the interview, Orrin shared his life lessons and insights through long stories that we could never include in their entirety in the film. Today, we're finally able to share some of those stories with you. Now in his 90s, Orrin Lyons is a chief, a faith keeper, and a longtime messenger for his people. In his youth, he was an exceptional lacrosse player at Syracuse University in upstate New York. When he graduated as a young artist and athlete, Orrin went home and received an altogether different type of education.
We were having a big celebration at Onondaga because our family was happy. My uncle said to me, he was sitting on the Council of Chiefs at that time, and he said, well, let's go fishing. And I said, that's a good idea. Yeah, because I knew he's a good fisherman. He knew where everything was. And so we went fishing. And he took me out on this lake, going to fish for bass. So I was very happy to be sitting there in the boat. And they had the motor, small motor, 15 horse. And we went out and anchored by a bluff, a lot of bass there. We got our lines out and we were sitting there. And he said, well, you just graduated from university. Yeah, I said, I did. That's good, he said. You know, it's been a long time since we had anybody do that. What'd you learn? Oh, I said, I took painting. I learned a lot about painting. That's good instruction, helped me out. That's good, he said. What else you learn? I said, I learned about people. We're pretty much brought up at Onondaga. And I said, different kinds of people. They think different. Yeah, I says, that's very true. I said, what else? I said, well, we had a good coach. Coach Simmons, good lacrosse coach. Nice man. Yeah, he says, I know Coach Simmons, a good man. Very nice man, he said. He was sitting there. Then you must know who you are, he said. And I said, yeah, I think so. Oh, we're just quiet for a while. And he says, can you tell me who you are? And I began to understand that I was sitting on one end of the boat, and he was on the other end of the boat by the motor, and I was kind of captured there. Well, I said, I'm Joey Clisson. Mm-hmm. He said, it's an old name, he said. It's an old name. Yeah, I said, I have that name. And I went on through my name, Warren Lyons, my mother's name, my father's name, their clans. My father was an eel, my mother was a wolf. And we go by the mother's side, so wolf clan, yeah. Then he would say, and that's it, huh? That's it, that's who you are. And I realized, you know, that I was being really cornered here. He was pressing me. And I went on to everything that I could possibly think of. And every time I would finish, he would say, that's it, huh? And I said, well, that's all I know. All right. Need help? I said, yeah. Yeah, apparently I need help. All right, he said, let me help you. And on the bluff, there was a young pine growing off the bluff, gripped right into the rock. And he said, you see that young tree? I said, yeah. He said, well, that's who you are. You're the same as that tree. You see how it's holding on to the earth? That's how you are. He said, we're dependent. We're rooted on the earth. We're part of the earth. We're the same as that tree. He says, you're the same. You're the same as that tree. You need water. You need light. You're dependent. Without the earth, you wouldn't be here. He said, that's why we say our mother. He says, because it's your mother. You're total dependent. I said, I see that. I understand that. Oh, he said, watch your line. You got a bite. And we caught a lot of fish that day. He didn't ask me any other question. But when we got home, I thought about this. I said, you know, he planned that whole thing from when he said, let's go fishing. Because he could see that I was arrogant in my position of who I was and feeling pretty good about myself and feeling pretty feisty, whatever all you want to say. And he could see I needed some instruction. You know, as time went on, the more I would think about it, the more I realized that he was concerned I was going to be going off in the wrong direction. I really needed help. So after 4 years of university, I learned more on that boat, a couple hours, and instructed by a man who never went beyond fifth grade, knew a lot more than I did. And so it gave me a base of reflection. He gave me a lot that day. Once in a while, I'll use that story when I'm talking to young people because they need the same instruction. And I would say probably the whole of America needs that same instruction because they don't know who they are. And that's what's sad about this whole thing, what's happening today in people. Is they're missing a whole lot just by not knowing that. They're missing most of it, actually. The relationship, then, basically, is what we're really are part of and have to understand.
It's now clear to many of us in the non-Indigenous world that we miss so much without that relationship. I know I've struggled to understand how to live in true affinity with the earth, to realize, as Oren's uncle pointed out, that we're the same as the trees, related as kin, not separate from other life forms or from the earth. Oren helped me understand how earth-based native cultures nurture this sense of relationship.
As you meet different people and become acquainted with your family, you begin to understand how deep their understanding about life is. They're very common people and very, what we would call just the average person. They have a lot of comprehension and understanding And it's based in the culture and how you live. And you learn about this stuff without understanding you're learning. You kind of absorb it. But in that process of how you live and where you live and how you learn that, that's, I guess, what people call culture. And it's so important to have that kind of a support system. And everyone, I believe, should every once in a while stop whatever they're doing and ask themselves that question, and who am I? Because people change, and you change without knowing it. And you'd be surprised when you ask that question. Find out you'll be drifting quite a ways away from what you thought, you know. It's important for people to know who they are. That's a fundamental question. In today's times, when there are 7 billion people in the world, half of them are children with no teachers, serious question. Nobody instructing. That's not a good idea, and that's not good for anybody, not good for the person, not good for the humanity itself, and not good for the earth itself, because if they don't know who they are, then they can become very, very destructive without even understanding that. So I think probably the statement that's most important here is to understand how closely we're related to the earth, and that we're part of the earth, and we're part of nature. Nature is us, basically, you know. And they always talk about environment, something like over there, or it's a category or something. No, we're it. We're in the middle of it. We're part of it, and we affect it, and we survive in it, and we are part of the earth. Now, if people understand that, that would be very helpful, because they'd be more careful about things. And so the question of recognizing where we are and who we are and why we call the earth our mother is simple, because you have respect. Everybody respects the mother. And so when we personify the sun, call our eldest brother, or the thunder, the lightning, we call our grandfathers, or the winds, we call our grandfathers. It's a personification that can draw you closer. That's what it's all about. We know our grandfathers, we know our uncles, we know. But we want to be close, and we want to be closer and closer. That's why we say, I'm a wolf. That's our family, a wolf. And so it helps us to relate. And I would say that's probably the biggest loss that I see in humanity now, is this loss of understanding of relationship. They don't understand their relationship.
Oren teaches lessons through the stories of his own life experiences, but also through the stories of his people. One of the most important stories for the Haudenosaunee is that of the peacemaker, the one who brought peace to the Mohawk, Oneida, Onondaga, Cayuga, and Seneca after they had been warring against each other for many years.
When we became a confederation some thousand years ago or more, and the peacemaker brought us all together in this whole confederation based on peace and based on equity and justice and based on the power of the good minds and to be united. He planted a symbol for us, a great tree of peace, a great white pine. And he said this white pine would have four roots of truth, white roots of peace that go in the four cardinal directions of the earth. And he said, and when people are lost, they have no place to go, they can follow that root back to its source and come under the protection of the great tree, the great law of peace. And he said to our leaders and our people at that time, he said, this tree represents the spiritual laws of nature. It represents the universal laws. And he said, never challenge those laws, because you will not prevail. That was instructions directly to our leaders and to our people, and they resonate today. And when we raise leaders, those same instructions are given again and again. And so to recognize who we are and where we are is fundamentally important for survival, because nature has no mercy. There's no mercy in nature. It's just the rules and the law. And if you don't know and understand those rules and law, then you will suffer the consequence. And so what's happened now that we see is our brothers have drifted so far away, they have no connection to those laws. They have no respect for those laws. They don't understand those laws. And the consequence of that is they violate them. And the consequence of that is they suffer in direct ratio. And so in today's times, we're facing severe crisis based upon, one, too many people, an out of balance side of the creation, and two, the law of nature, a consequence of that out of balance. I don't know what it takes to educate people, perhaps this kind of a session where we just flat exchange ideas and thoughts directly, maybe that's the best way, but it's always been with us, the experience, and actually living the process, which is fundamentally the best way to learn. And to learn, you have to have teachers. And who's your teacher? And the teacher is nature, the earth. You learn, and you learn how to get along, you learn how to be respectful. So from what I see and from what I know in my travels is the indigenous people have about the best understanding of this. But not the only ones. I've met people, different parts of the world understand that. They're not indigenous, they're old people, been around a long time. I find in Europe they're very, very strong about that. And then even here, I can remember, speaking to some old farmers. They understand quite a bit about that because they work with it every day. They live with it. They have to. They have to understand it because they're part of it and they live with it. So there's plenty of people that have this knowledge and have this understanding. But basically, they're not in charge. And that's our problem that I see today, that everything today is based on economy, they call economy. And that's so far out of balance and out of whack that we're just challenging every law there is out there right now. And the consequence of that is what we're facing. There's no mercy in nature at all. So if you transgress, you suffer in direct ratio to your transgression. Simple as that.
But while facing today's challenges, Oren still finds guidance and hope in the peacemaker story.
When the peacemaker first brought our five nations together who had forgotten their original instructions, fighting terrible times, and he finally got them all together by Onondaga Lake. They sat by that beautiful lake up there, we're still there. And he gave us our instructions, gave us everything all at once. And he said, when you sit in your council for the welfare of the people, think not of yourself, nor of your family, nor even your generation. He said, make your decision on behalf of those generations coming. Those faces looking up from the earth, layer upon layer, coming. That's your responsibility, so that when they come, they'll have a place as good as yours and they'll enjoy life as you're enjoying it now. When the peacemaker brought us together, he instructed us. And when we raise leaders, that same instruction comes forward again. A lot of instruction talked about the seventh generation. That's just one of them. He said, you who are going to be leaders, he says, you're going to have skin that's seven spans thick, seven spans of my hand thick. he says, like the bark of a tree, to protect you from the insults which you're going to receive from the people. And you have to absorb that. And you can't respond in kind. You have to listen to what they're saying. He says, they may be angry, but there's a message there. And you have to find out what that is. So you have to have a lot of tolerance for what's coming to your direction. Prepare yourself. And he said, don't wait around for any thanks because they're not going to give it to you. But you do what you have to do. And that's your position. And your work is to look out for the welfare. He said, into your hands, we're going to put all life. We're placing all life in your hands. And that's a very broad statement. And that's why I'm not out of place being over here. This is part of my responsibility here as well as anywhere. And so that's the way we look at it. And he said, there will be these times coming. And you have to maintain these elements that I'm going to give you for your confederation. The first one being peace. Peace. When we greet one another, we say, Nyawaha Skano. Skano is peace. Nyawaha, thank you. And it's the same for health, Skano. Same word. So we're saying, thank you for being healthy. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being peaceful. Nyawaha Skano. Kwasha Dogas, we say. What you say is true. Yes. Kwasha Dogas. It's true. And so that's our greeting. So peace and health. You can't have peace without health. And he said the second is going to be equity. Equity, not only for the people, but equity for life. Everything in balance, to be fair to everything. Equity. And with equity comes justice. You can't have justice without equity. The third one, he said, was the power of the good minds, to be of one mind. So you work for peace, to be unified. Unity is your strength. And so we have to become unified. So those instructions are basis for the Haudenosaunee, called the Six Nation Iroquois. That's our long-term fundamental process. And he plant the great tree of peace as a symbol. And it's always about peace, and it's always about equity, and it's always about respect, and it's always about nature. And that's where we have to go, and we have to do this. We have to do this collectively. It can't be done by one section. So who are the teachers? So the teachers who know that the best are indigenous people. I don't care where you go, they'll tell you the same thing. I hear it all over. It's just natural. We know the same thing. And when we hear people praying in one language, we don't have to understand what they're saying. We know what they're saying. We say the same thing. So we have to bring the rest of the world into that context. They have to understand their relationship and their responsibilities. But what we're saying at that time was to be unified and to work collectively for the good of the people, for the good of the commons. And somehow that's been perverted into individual. Somehow or other, the commons succumb to the individual rights, and that's not right, and that don't work. And the result of it is what we see right now.
My work for the last four decades has centered on telling stories of indigenous people defending their sacred lands. I asked Oren about what should be done to better protect sacred places, those specific, special sites that anchor entire cultures. But he immediately critiqued my premise.
In fact, the whole earth is sacred. It's your mother all together, and I don't care where you are. There's no place that's not special. There's no place that's not to be respected. I don't care where you are. And we use the word sacred now. That's not an Indian word. That comes from Europe, you know. Comes from your churches. We have our own ways, and we have our own way to say things. But it means the same. It means it's a place that people gather. And Onondaga Lake would be one of them for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons is where that's where the great tree of peace is planted. Still there. Kanaktakoyio, they say. Where the root is. The root. Still there. Even though there's a city around it, even though there's boats all over it, it's still the same. And we'll go there. quietly. And so, special places, special time, when a peacemaker gave us all of that on those shores, that becomes a special place, Onondaga. And in today's times and in today's context, where it's the most polluted lake maybe in the world because of the amount of mercury it has in it, it's amazing, you know, that that can happen. I remember as a young man, we used to fish, whitefish, good food. We used to spear, catch whitefish, and they would come out that lake. And then later on, I find out it was a whitefish center in the east. There's none there now. They're gone because of the pollution. And now, where do you go when there's no place to go? So now the fish that are loaded up with bad things, and they have a place to go because that's where they live. And it's the same thing as living in Los Angeles when all of that smog comes down. You have no place to go. You're there. You're stuck with it. You breathe it. Fish are the same way. The animals the same way. Where are you going to run? You know, we're so lucky today. We're sitting right here in a place where the air is clean. You can smell it. It's clean. It's still clean here, but that's because all these mountains and everything helping out here. They're working together. But now the whole earth is being covered with smoke. And we were told that long ago, this is going to happen. And it's happening now. And so sacred is a good word. It can be used for a lot of good things. And the way we use it is probably means a place to be respected, a place to be careful.
I pressed Oren to go deeper into this paradox. All of the earth is sacred, but there are some special sites. And he explained how indigenous communities take care of culturally significant places.
There's no place that should not be respected. But there are some special places, very special places. They're there for a reason, been there for a long time. And people still go there, they still gather. Not only people, but animals too. They have their own special places, they gather. They know. And it is special, it requires certain kind of attention. It's for the good of everything and the good of everybody. And that's what people have to understand about these ceremonies and everything. When we hold our strawberry ceremony, we're not just talking about for Onondaga strawberries. We're talking about all the earth. We're talking about for everybody. So the ceremony is for everybody. You don't have to be there. You just be grateful that it's going on, that we're keeping it up. That's what's important, that it takes place. And sometimes you can be there and most of the time you can't, but be grateful that somebody's looking after that spiritual side of things. That's what's the real world, actually, the spiritual side of it. And you can't see, but it's probably the most real of all. And here we are, we're lucky, fortunate to be where we are. So what we've done and what's happening is we've lost the balance on the earth very well. Done a good job at it. In our meeting that we had yesterday, I talked to people about 1950, when there were 2.5 billion people in the world, and how long it took to get to that 2.5 billion. It took millions of years. And then up to today, there's 7 billion people in the world today, 61 years later, more than double. That's not sustainable. We're way out of balance. And that's a natural event. That's nature. Procreation is nature. That's what we do best. And that's what people know how to do the best, and they like it. You're not going to change that. And so we got all these people. And in another 10 years, you're going to have another billion. That's people who are going to have water, food, and a place to live. And we're losing water and food. We're going the other way with that. Less water, less food. smaller place to live. So you're coming to a crisis of our own making. And what we've done by having so many people is we've affected the big systems that we live under, and the rules of law of nature. And we've changed that just by being so many and being so disruptive and by polluting everything. Human beings are very parasitic. They take a lot and don't put much back. Earth doesn't need us. Doesn't need us at all. But we need the earth. So we can't come to that understanding, it seems. We've affected the systems to the point of melting the ice in the north. And we've pulled the trigger on change. And the trigger's pulled, and it's happening. And it will just continue to get worse. So we have to prepare ourselves, as one old chief said long time ago, Seattle, come up from the Northwest, he said, there's going to come a time, he says, when people are going to cease living and begin surviving. And it's going to get worse from there. We're just pushing it. And there's going to be no place to hide. When these things begin to happen, it's all going to be very democratic. Very democratic. No place to run. So we have a little time.
Oren Lyons has been paying close attention to the climate catastrophe for many years, and he offers a way forward. What we should do with the little time we have left to try to turn things around.
The ice is melting. It's melting in the north. It's melting pretty fast. I was in Sweden around 2000. Just happened to be watching television there. And there was a statement that came over the television which really made me blink. The University of Bergen said that the currents of the earth, the Gulf Stream, was slowing down. And that if it continued to slow down at the pace it was slowing down now, that it could conceivably stop within the next 15 years. That was 2000. Here we are, 2011. They're talking 4 years from now. And what happens? So I called some of my friends in Sweden. I said, check that out. And they did. 15 minutes later, they said, yep, that's the report, came back. So I said, well, what's it mean? They said, well, the current affects the winds. The current affects everything. That's what keeps things in balance while it's slowing down. I said, what will happen if it stops altogether? They said, ice. Have an ice age. I said, well, they said up 15 years. So I've been watching that. I've been thinking about that. And so we talked with the Inupiat, the Inuit people from Greenland. They said, yes, the ice is melting and it's going to go all. Nothing going to stop it. They said the white bear is mating with the brown bear now, trying to adjust. Things are out of kilter, out of whack, all over. And if you want to experience that, go up to the Arctic and you'll see where the damage is taking place right now. And we're kind of insulated from that way down here, but it's going to get here. And they're very angry up there, the native people. I said, we keep hearing about saving the white bear. They said, what about us? We're here too. We've been here. But it's coming. And we pull the trigger, and how it happens and how it can be mitigated is up to us right now. We're in charge of our own fate. Totally, completely in charge of our own fate. And what happens to us, it'll be determined by us. We're in charge.
So if we are in charge, what can we do?
Well, they can't fly off to another planet, I know that. You know, we hear that kind of nonsensical talk. If anybody goes off to another planet, it'll be the most wealthiest people in the world. And that's what they do. But they don't know, you're not going to run from that. No, we're going to have to work together. We're going to have to sit down. A global problem requires a global solution. So one country can't do something great and another country doesn't. They have to work collectively together. And nature's going to force that. But the question remains, will it be soon enough to mitigate? It's going to play out. So some of my scientific friends say, we might escape the ice. We might. We're not sure. We just don't know. But we know it's happening. The two main, what I see as compound actions going on right now is the ice melting. It's a compound action, which means it's exponential in nature. It's explosive. Starts slow and ends fast. So the acceleration is what you're going to be experiencing. It's going to get faster and faster. And I notice, I've been watching this closely, and it's just ironic every time I read it. Some headline says, by scientists, it's happening faster than we thought. You see it all over now, and it's going to get more and more. So the compounding of the ice melting is slowing down the current. The current slowed down. It allows the water in the Caribbean to heat up. That water heating up is going to give you bigger winds. Those bigger winds are what's going to whack you very hard, and you're seeing it right now. I don't know how many people have been killed by tornadoes this year alone. And how many tornadoes in one day? Unheard of in one day. And yet people seem not even to acknowledge it. You take the obfuscation of truth that's going on in media today. That's part of all of this business, why people are not responding, because they're being lied to. They're being misled deliberately for profit. That's where the problem lies. It lies in industrial life. It doesn't lie in the natural world or indigenous world. It's, the problem is here. And since the United States has the biggest carbon footprint in the world, 1/4 of the carbon of the world coming from the United States and our activities, China's nowhere near the carbon footprint we put out, but they're moving in that direction. So that compound action is going to change everything and change the weather. The weather's changing now. It's systemic change. I mean, the weather is just a symptom of it, but it's a systems change. And so we've affected the patterns of the Earth, and we're going to suffer that consequence. The other compound is human population. We're forcing the rest of the world to accommodate to us. So now you can count the gorillas. It's just a small family up there trying to hold on. Peaceful. They're peaceful, these gorillas. Peaceful people. And there's very few left. They're fighting hard for survival. Elephants the same way. Got them pinched into a small place, now they're out there in everybody's garden, so they're shooting them down, and you got this chaos coming. And so now the ice is melting, the white bear can't get the seal. The seal's standing out there 20 feet away in open water. He's not going to catch him. So he's starving. He's starving, and the seal is growing, so now the seal's eating all the fish. Fishing that we're depending on, and we're eating all the fish. We've broken the cod. You know, they named it Cape Cod. Why do you think they named it Cape Cod? The most cod in the world. Well, not anymore. We did that. The herring are gone. It's all going. And then population is growing. So what are they going to eat? And where are they going to go? Less than 2% of the water in the earth is you can drink. That's what we're facing. We're facing serious calamity. But I think, you know, the earth doesn't allow this to happen. Since it's for nature, the earth takes care of these excess populations all the time. The lemmings, they go and run off into the sea. They just disappear. They just kill each other. And then here's the rabbits. And every 4 years, a disease comes, wipes them out, and there are just a few left, and 4 years later, there they are all over the place again, and they're gone again. We're in the same category. So the first wave that's going to take us is going to be a pandemic. That's nature's way of taking care of overpopulation. And any scientist that deals in pathology will tell you we're just a half a step away from that right now. We had a little scare with SARS. Closed down Hong Kong, closed down Toronto, closed down New York, closed down cities. It was just a little bit. Can you imagine the real one? Yeah, that's where we are.
Listening back to this now, I'm amazed that in 2011, Oren foresaw the devastation of the COVID pandemic. He says the only way to heal the chaos humans have created is to share, to live with respect, and to embrace responsibility.
Well, land is the earth. Land is our mother. The earth is the source of life. It's the source of life. It's alive. The earth is alive. No doubt about it. It's alive. And so we're so dependent. And so how's the best way to do that is to respect and understand. And that's where we've lost our way. I think as a human species, we've lost the understanding and therefore lost the respect. But pockets of indigenous people have hung on to that. We're truly an endangered species. You know, they've been trying to instruct Indians to be capitalists ever since they got here. And they keep failing all the time because we don't value what you value. We give it away, you know. They say, you people never amount to anything. You just keep giving it stuff away, you know. We work on that, you know. The Lakotas are great at that. They have what they call giveaways, you know. And the people out there in the Northwest, they have these potlatches where they give everything away and they borrow money to give more away. Why? It's to keep the peace. It's to share. So if there is something that we have to relearn, it's the idea of sharing, sharing equally, and being responsible. That's what we have to learn. We have to learn to share.
As with so many of his points, Oren had a long story about the 1992 UN Conference on Sustainable Development, or UNCET, in Brazil, to illustrate how to share.
We were in Rio, 1992, at UNCET, big meeting down there, 192 countries there. And the United States wasn't showing up, but the pressure was on them. When finally President Bush shows up, forced to. This world pressure forced him to show up. Well, we were there, Indians were there, and we were meeting ahead of time. We had support people coming from all over. There was this young girl, this young lady, who said to me, I want to go, and I don't have any money. And I said, we can't help, you know, we're trying ourselves to get down there. You just got to look and find somebody, you know. It was like a calling, as to me, all of the people interested in community and spirit and the land and the earth all went. They came from all over the world there. It was an amazing meeting. And sure enough, here's this girl shows up. There she is. Oh, I see you made it. Yeah, I made it. And got very disgusted with the meetings right away. And we didn't see her much around. Then we bumped into her later on, and we were eating in a restaurant. She came in, and she was collecting uneaten food. And apparently had something worked out because the people who were running the restaurant were giving her this food, uneaten food, and said, hey, what are you doing? She said, I'm feeding the kids out there, the feral kids in the street. I said, really? I'm tired up there. She said, they're just saying the same old, same old. She said, I'm trying to help these kids. I said, come with me. So I went with her. And we went in the street, and she had like six plastic containers of food. And I see a little head peek out around a corner under a street light, and recognized her, but not me. It's afraid of me, you know? It was like a rabbit coming out, a feral kid, about 6, 7 years old, the way I figure. Skinny came out, came across, looking at me all the time, you know? And she gave him the food. You never seen such a beautiful smile, never. He flashed a smile and took that food and he was gone. She says, watch. And down under the streetlight, about 8 of them, 7 or 8 children, all about the same size, came out. And they sat in a circle under that light, and they took that food, one plate at a time, and one bite at a time. They went around, each one taking a bite. They shared every bite equal with everybody. I said, that's the lesson. Not up there where they're talking about Unset and all these people preaching about justice and equity. 7 kids in a circle sharing one bite. I said, that's the lesson. That little girl, young girl, was doing more towards the issue than all of that. And what did President Bush say when he got there? Didn't say much, but what he said was, the living standard of the American people is not up for discussion here, he said. That was his message. 192 people gathered around the world for common good. And what does the leader of the largest powerful nation in the world say? The living standard of the American people are not up for discussion here. And 7 kids sitting in a circle, sharing one bite at a time. That's the lesson. And that's what we have to do.
So I asked Orrin, how do we get from George Bush's attitude to living like those 7 children, sharing in a circle?
Well, it's very hard, you know, because it's hard to change the American mind because it's so ingrained. John Adams, one of the founding fathers of this country, they say. He had a statement. I can only paraphrase it, but it's a good one. I have it somewhere. I believe, he said, my family has cut down more trees than any other family in this country. He's very proud of the fact. We have cut down more trees than any other family in this country. So the symbol of our brother across the water coming over here is an axe. It's a symbol of destruction. It's ingrained. I mean, that was an ethic. He was speaking an American ethic. The ethic was an axe and destruction. So you say, how do you change that? My goodness, look how ingrained it is, how difficult it is. Not to say that we shouldn't try. And I don't have the answer, but I think maybe what you're doing, you know, which is to carry the message to as many people as you can, because it's one person at a time. Every person has to make up their own mind. So your work is good. Your work is positive. And it's awareness. You have to bring these ideas and thoughts to people who don't have access to them. The American media is controlled. Anybody can tell you that. And people's consumption is controlled, and they are controlled very cleverly. I mean, any American male can tell you just about what the batting average of any major leaguer is in a country. They can tell you, write down, know the batting averages of individuals. They don't know anything about the Continental Congress or Ben Franklin or anything about the Six Nations or anything about the Lakotas or Seattle, great leaders, Tecumseh, fighting for peace, basically fighting for peace, equity. Our leaders were always in service. That's our work, is service, service to the people. Best you can, long as you can. So that's what leaders should do, at least from our perspective. So how do you do that? Well, you do that by what you're doing, is try to collect up these statements here and there. And like I say, I'm just a runner. I'm not any great wisdom carrier. I'm just carrying a lot of other people's thoughts and ideas, you know. And I believe in it. That's what I do. I believe that. That's why I'm here. And why I will say what I say. Because I believe it. I'm getting mad. Getting angry. That's what it is, because it's frustrating. Frustrating because of the control factors. How they've just really amazingly taken democracy right out of America. That's just amazing. Very deliberate and very well done. You have to admire their ability. One thing we've always understood, never underestimate your enemy. Never. That's how we survive.
Time passed after we finished the film, and I stayed in touch with Oren. After the election of Donald Trump, we found ourselves facing a new threat, one not to be underestimated. I met up with Oren again at the State University of New York in Syracuse. Trump had just been elected. I was on my way to the showdown at Standing Rock, and the Potawatomi biologist and writer, Professor Robin Kimmerer, hosted a screening of the Standing on Sacred Ground series. Oren and I appeared on stage after the film, and he had some serious words of caution, a history lesson of sorts for the students in attendance.
I'm really proud of the people that's out there with Standing Rock, because they haven't responded to what they're trying to do. They're trying to incite them to riot is exactly what they're trying to do, so that they can come in. And once a gun goes off, then all discussion is over. And it's done. Becomes a gunfight. So holding that line and the way they're holding it is really amazing to me. Now, they've been provoking them way beyond. That bull mastiff, that dog, came over with the conquistadores. He'd been here a long time, that dog. He's hunted Indians for a long time. He's still hunting Indians. What do you think about that? That bull mastiff, very same dog. 500 years later, there he is. Amazing. You know, the last time I saw really people being sprayed with a hose intentionally in the winter was at these Nazi concentration camps. That's really, really a crime to spray any people in the winter with water. That's where you should be talking. That's a crime. That's assault and battery. So the treaty out there, 1851, is a strong treaty. And the fact that it is violated doesn't mean it was abrogated. It was violated. It means it still stands. It hasn't been changed. When this country was just being formed in 1784, it had a treaty with our people here, Treaty of Peace, and there was a great interference going on at that particular time. And it was coming from a Governor Clinton. He was very active. He was trying to buy land. He was trying to move people. He was causing problems. So when they made the Constitution, they put in there, in Article 6, that treaties are the supreme law of the land, notwithstanding anything else. And that was directed to Governor Clinton to not provoke the Haudenosaunee. That's where that came from. Treaties are the supreme law of the land, and you should be defending those treaties because you're the other half of it. Not the government, not Obama or Trump, you. You have a say. You have a right to speak up on that treaty. We made an agreement. Our treaty stands. 1751 is strong. It's up to you. You want to ask what to do? That's what you do. Behave yourself. Follow that treaty. Start talking about it. It's important. It's still there. And until they change Article 6, the Constitution, that is constitutional law. It prevails over everything else, and that governor included out there. The same governor as Clinton right here, he's the same guy, acting the same way. Want to do something? Do that. Talk to them about the treaties. That's your treaty. That's your agreement. If you allow that to be trampled, I hate to use the term, cutting your children's throats. You're losing your nation. That's what's going on. Now we're here. We're going to be here. We ain't going nowhere. Good work.
To listen to more from my interview with Orrin Lyons, tune into part two, where Orrin explains the Haudenosaunee influence on the creation of the American government, shares an interpretation of the Wizard of Oz, and offers more guidance about a way out of our predicament. You can find that episode at sacredland.org, along with our full audio archive, as well as films, resources, and suggested actions you can take to protect sacred places. This episode was produced and written by Callie Shanafelt Wong and Toby McLeod. Our film interview with Orrin was recorded by Andy Black and Dave Wendlinger, along with co-producer Jessica Abbey. This episode is brought to you by the Sacred Land Film Project of Earth Island Institute, based in Lejeune Ohlone Territory in Berkeley, California. Thanks for joining us.